Okay. Call it to order. Call Education Finance Committee will come to order.
The Education Finance Committee will come to order.
Call the department to the table.
Senator Stumpf will not be here this morning. I would like to call the department to the table to continue reviewing the governor's budget and proposal.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Deputy Commissioner Chaz, state your name for the record.
My name is Chaz Anderson. I'm the Deputy Education Commissioner at the Department of Education. Leaving off from yesterday, I believe we left off on page 24, subdivision 2C of the bill. Before we start, Madam Chair, we have two technical amendments to the budget bill. If you would like, we can adopt them right now, or we can just wait for that when they come up in the articles that pertain to those amendments.
Deputy Commissioner, we don't have a quorum right now, so we can't adopt them, but let's get them passed out, and then we'll do that when we do have a quorum.
Okay, and we can just take those up, too, when we discuss the articles where we're making those changes as well.
That'd be fine.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Starting on page 24, then, subdivision 2C, this is the third component of the governor's 3R high school proposal. It's a requirement of a personal graduation plan for those students in high school that starts beginning no later than grade 9. As part of that graduation plan, it's supposed to look at exploring career options, matching careers with student-identified interests and skills, identify the student's academic and career goals, monitor progress for on-time graduation, and it also requires that the parental involvement in the graduation plan. Subdivision 2D is the fourth component of the 3R high school proposal. This is requiring that the school provide effective professional development for teachers and principals. That goes from subdivision 2, numbers 1 and 2. Subdivision E of the proposal is the fifth component of the Minnesota High School proposal, and that is the requirement of to provide rigorous and relevant course-taking for all students. Going on to page 25, subdivision F, that is the last component of the 3R high school proposal. That's a requirement that high schools that enter into this plan develop and implement an effective data system that monitors, does things like monitor student progress, identify the needs and challenges of specific students, provides instructions that meets the student's identified needs, analyzes student data for academic purposes and planning purposes, and also ensures on-time graduation.
Sure, always.
Subdivision 3 is the aid portion of the proposal. As we discussed yesterday, high schools that decide to enter into this program for the 2007-2008 school year, they will receive $68 per student for grades 9 through 12 to begin planning and putting together a plan for full implementation for the 2008-2009 school year, in which they will receive $200 per student for grades 9 through 12. Going on to page 26, section 6.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Deputy Commissioner, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Anderson, this $200, is that just for the second year, or does that continue?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, that continues on as long as the high school is implementing or are moving forward with their plan. So it is not one-time money. It is permanent money to their base funding. And as I said yesterday, it's available for every high school that decides to participate. So theoretically, we could have 100% of high schools participating and receiving the $200 per student in their base funding and continuing on.
Ms. Anderson, thank you. Can we go back to subdivision 2B on page 23? A 3R high school must contract with a provider approved by the Department of Education to implement a college access program. Can you talk a little bit about what the intent is? Who are you suggesting that the schools would use, and how does that differentiate from the counselors they have currently in their schools?
Sure. Madam Chair, the intention of that is not to replace the existing counselors that are in schools, but rather provide supplemental services to help out those counselors. And what college access programs tend to look at is students that are on the edge that could go to college if given the right supports, and that might be academically, it may be counseling parents with financial aid, and other planning for high school and what they need for post-secondary education. As you look at the dual credit requirement that we have proposed here, it might be help assisting those parents and students with meeting those requirements and educating them on how to meet those requirements. And so what the college access programs really look to do is focus on some of the at-risk students that could go on to post-secondary education very successfully. A number of programs already exist, particularly in our urban school districts. Examples would be Admissions Possible, which focuses on getting students information, especially first-generation students whose parents may not speak English very well, information that they need to make decisions as they're going with their child's education. There's other programs like AVID, I know that's in the St. Paul Public Schools, that looks at tutoring students that if they had additional tutoring and supplementing what the counselors are doing, those students will have a better success in going on to college. So it's really looking at different programming that schools can bring in to target students that need to get up to speed in order to enter into post-secondary education after high school.
Ms. Anderson, is it the department's opinion that every high school in the state must contract with an outside provider? That's how I read this.
Yes. Madam Chair, there's a many different college access programs and needs. And, for instance, a school in Minnetonka does not have the same needs as a school in Minneapolis. So what levels they contract and who they target those students to is really a decision that's made by the high school. Because every high school has students probably that are on the edge of whether or not they attend college, even a Minnetonka high school. And so the level of contracted services and what is provided is up to the school when they put together their plan.
And Ms. Anderson, what if we're talking about schools in the rural parts of Minnesota who might think that they have plenty of resources to provide these services to the students themselves?
What those, Madam Chair, what those schools might do is have an articulated agreement with a Minsku institution as they implement maybe concurrent enrollment or college in the schools, that the college may provide some of that programming as part of the dual credit high school post-secondary education credit. So it's not just existing program. It could be higher institutions that are doing that. It could be service cooperatives. It could be a variety of services within the school district that also, as long as they can demonstrate that they're meeting those needs of those students, that service then can be provided by that provider. So in a sense, if a school district can show or a higher education institution can show they can provide those services and they demonstrate that they can meet standards, then those entities could provide those services as well.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'm a little confused. Section B says a 3R high school must contract with a provider. Does that mean they cannot use their own counselors or cannot hire?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, what the intent is that there would be a set of criteria that the department would set that they would have to meet in order to become a certified provider. And so if a school district decided that if hiring an additional counselor or two would help them meet those requirements and they could demonstrate that, then they could be a provider of those services.
And they pay for these funds with this $200 a year that they get per pupil?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, yes, they could.
Thank you. And Ms. Anderson, one concern that I might have is that there could be a duplication of services if we do have our counselors that are fulfilling that function and are doing so effectively. And so I understand that then the school would have to negotiate that and put forward that approach in a plan. But I am concerned about what message that sends to our counseling community.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if the school can demonstrate that in their plan, then they shouldn't be duplicating services. And there's a lot of things in this three-hour high school plan that a lot of high schools are already doing. And so it's not meant to say you have to do more. If you're already doing those services, it doesn't mean you have to do something different or something in addition to if the services are effective, but you just have to demonstrate in your local plan that's how you're providing the services. So it's not meant to duplicate any effort, but they just have to demonstrate that in the plan that's submitted.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, going on to page 26, section 6, this is the Advanced Placement International Baccalaureate Statute. Just some history on this. In 2005, the legislature appropriated $4.5 million each year for Advanced Placement International Baccalaureate to pay for exam fees and to pay for teacher training for those programs. I'm excited to say that with that additional money, we've seen growth of 18.5% in advanced placement programming and 11% growth in international baccalaureate programming since the legislature passed that additional funding. In addition to that, this is the first year actually we've been able to pay for all of the exam fees for AP and IB for all students. And so that's been a very great accomplishment that all students that took exams in AP and IB receive full reimbursement for those fees. In addition to that, the 2006 legislature appropriated $1 million for expanding advanced placement programming. That money was one-time funding. Those schools have received grants to expand their AP programming, and building on the success of the legislation from 2005 and 06, the governor is recommending $7.3 million in fiscal year 08 and $8.1 million in fiscal year 09 to expand AP and IB programming. If you look at the statute, we're taking the existing statute that passed in 06 and just including international baccalaureate in that, along with advanced placement.
Ms. Anderson, couldn't you remind us how much currently do students pay for the exams?
Madam Chair, I believe it depends on if you're a student of poverty and a student you're not a student of poverty. The College Board pays for a portion of a fee for students that are at risk. But generally, the fee for AP is about $85 per exam, and it's well over $100 for international baccalaureate. I can check on that and give you exact figures, but they can be quite expensive, and that's for one exam. So a student may take several exams during the course of a year, and generally, we have paid for most of the exam fees for students at risk, but not for those other students. And so this is the first time we've been able to pay for all exam fees for all students.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you, Ms. Anderson, what is the basis for the differential in the charges, excuse me, between those programs? Are these tests electronically graded or manually, or what drives that expensive a process or a cost for handling or processing those exams?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I believe what's driving the cost of IB exams is the process they have for having the exams scored, have numerous professors and people that score the IB exam versus the AP exam is a little more standardized. But I would have to get more information to you to explain that, the difference in the exam fees.
Thank you. I would like that.
We do have a quorum present now, members. Ms. Anderson, when you do have that information, could you provide that to the rest of the committee as well?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I will do so.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, would you like to take up the amendments?
Yes, thank you.
All right. I'm with the first one that, Madam Chair, that we'll take up is the A2 amendment. And this is changes made in Article 7 and 9. Article 7 is our early childhood section. Article 9, the changes in Article 9 is our fatherhood initiative proposal. And My understanding is that these are technical changes and that they'll be explained when the articles are presented.
Senator Olson moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's adopted.
Madam Chair, the next amendment is the A3 amendment. This is actually making a change to appropriation. The Reading Corps program was listed as $1.9 million. It was supposed to be $1 million per year. So that's putting the bill in order to reflect the governor's budget.
Senator Saxhog moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion's adopted.
Madam Chair, going on to page 29, section 7, this is the teacher induction program the governor is recommending. This program focuses on new teachers, mentoring programs for new teachers in high shortage license areas. Right now, we define that as math, science, world languages, and special education, and in high need schools and districts across the state. Generally, we see quite a bit of shortages in the northwest, southwest, and northeast part of the state in terms of finding teachers to fill teaching job positions. We also find across the state difficulties filling positions in science, math, special ed, and world languages. So this program will focus on mentoring those new teachers so that we can retain those teachers once we do get them into the classroom. Minnesota's data is not that far behind from national data that shows that about 50% of the teachers leave the classroom in the first 5 years. So what this proposal is attempting to do is
Members, this is line 74 on your spreadsheet.
What this proposal is supposed to do or attempting to do is retain teachers in high license and high need schools. That proposal goes on.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, before you get too far beyond, I apologize for going back. I had one question more on your advanced that raised academic achievement advanced placement programs. Is this connected with resources or that allows the money to be used for expanding into other grade levels? Is this opening it up broadly to go beyond just the high school level for both AP and IB?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. The proposal allows schools to spend funds on pre-advanced placement, which is the middle school years programming to advanced placement. That's relatively new, and actually we do have a number of schools that are starting that in Minnesota, but it's to pre-advanced placements prepare students to take AP in high school. And then the International Baccalaureate program has a primary years program, a middle years program, and then a diploma program at high school. Both programs expand beyond before the high school, but they do have programming also in the high school.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Anderson, The provision that we have that waives our standards for these advanced programs apply then so that we essentially would be waiving it for an entire program?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that was a provision that passed last year as part of the rigorous course waiver that exempts AP and IB from the academic standards in the thought of that students taking those courses are going beyond Minnesota's academic standards, and so yes, it would. We do work with those schools. All of the IB schools that we work with have aligned their curriculum to the Minnesota academic standards, and so we don't see that as being a big issue as we move forward.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Anderson.
Going to the next section, section 8 on page 31. This is the governor's proposal on math and science teacher academies. This is a proposal to establish regional centers to assist teachers.
Line 72 on your spreadsheet.
To assist teachers with professional development and training in our new math and science standards. As members may know, we are currently revising the math standards and putting in additional math requirements as part of that 2006 legislation that passed. And so what we are really seeing a need of out in the field is training and professional development in both math and science for all our teachers, not just our math and science teachers, because we know that even our elementary teachers will play a significant role in achieving the higher math and science standards and requirements we are putting in place. And so Section 8, which is in Subdivision 5, that additional language reflects the governor's proposal on this initiative. Madam Chair, Section 9 and Section 10 is the Reading Corps program. This is a program that's administered by the Youth Works program, which is a Minnesota's AmeriCorps program. There will probably be a separate bill. I know there will be a separate bill on this initiative that, oh, and Senator Saltzman just shows me the jackets, that that will be probably have a separate hearing on this, and the Youth Works program, or Serve Minnesota program, they're also called, will come in and present information on this. And so this reflects that proposal in the governor's budget to provide $1 million a year in additional funding to do grade ages 3 to grade 3 interventions in reading. This proposal has been initiated at the St. Croix River Valley Education District. They've shown some significant success with reading intervention with children, and the governor is recommending that $1 million per year be allocated for this program. In addition, and this is something I believe Serve Minnesota can go into more detail than I will, but the state money does leverage additional federal money. How much, it's unclear right now, but Serve Minnesota, I'm sure, will be able to provide that information to the committee.
And this is line 16 on your... 60, excuse me. Senators Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Anderson, is this a section of the bill just for that particular program, or could it be any intervention program?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, it is for this particular reading program. Madam Chair, Section 11 is the governor's recommendation for an alternative school calendar pilot program. As you may know, there are some, educational organizations that are proposing to add additional days to the school calendar. This is actually a quite expensive option for the state. It costs about $31 million per year for every day we put on the calendar. And so what the governor is recommending is establishing a six-year pilot project that looks at alternative school calendars and its effectiveness before moving forward with any large-scale initiative to increase the number of school days that we have for the school year.
Ms. Anderson, can you speak to why 6 years? That seems a long amount of time for a pilot.
Madam Chair, generally research shows that it takes between 5 to 7 years to really be able to show a program's or a initiative's effectiveness. And so we pick 6 years because our biennial budget is 2 year increments, and if the research is 5 to 7 years, we basically took 6 years. And but that's the reason for the pilot program. We've had pilots last. I've seen pilot programs last up to 10 years, but this generally was fitting into the research we have found on being able to judge effectiveness of programming.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. The next section is Section 12, which is the governor's recommendation for Mandarin Chinese startup grants. As you may know, the legislature last year passed an initiative.
Line 64.
Passed an initiative to study Mandarin Chinese programming. We do have quite a significant push from schools to put in Mandarin Chinese program, interesting enough. We are working on a number of initiatives at the department, including increasing the supply of licensed teachers in that area. But this program would provide grant funding to schools that are interested in starting up a Mandarin Chinese program. And sometimes there's some additional costs of starting up a new, particularly a new world language program. And this would provide grants to schools that may be interested in doing so.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, is there a particular grade level that these are targeted to, or is that open?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it is open. It's not targeted at a particular grade level.
Ms. Anderson, if a school district has just begun this program, would they, even though they say we're in year two of it, would they be eligible to receive these grant monies?
Madam Chair, it really would depend. We typically don't allow schools to supplant existing programming with grant funding. But in cases like that, they may be trying to expand to additional grades or add additional grades as they go with students and may have additional costs in doing so, and they could certainly submit a proposal to request additional funds for that.
Thank you. And this, members, is line 33.
On page 34. Oh, it says enhancing successful models.
Oh, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, section 13 is the successful schools program. This is the appropriation for that program. This provides between a 1.5% and 2.5% increase for schools that successfully achieve a 3-star rating in math or reading.
Line 71 on your chart.
The 1.5% to 2.5% is approximately $90 to $150 per student. This is not yet cannot yet be determined exactly how much funding they would receive, because we do not know the results of the report card or the rating system, and so it will fluctuate depending on how many schools achieve a 3-star in reading or math. This program is one-time funding available to the school. This was part of, as you know, about $1 billion one-time surplus we had, and the governor recommended a number of spending items for that one-time surplus, this being one of them. This is $150 million for the biennium, and it's $75 million per year. This money, as I said, can be spent for any uses except for permanent staff salary increases. Members, going to Section 14, this is the appropriations section, and I'm just going to point out the appropriations where we've recommended an increase from the base funding, unless you would like to take it up differently.
That's fine, Ms. Anderson. Okay.
Madam Chair, if you go to subdivision 12, the statewide testing and reporting system, the governor is recommending to that program, some of them being a base increase for the general testing program and others being a formative assessment for voluntary formative assessment for schools to use. The first, he's recommending $15.3 million in fiscal year 08, $19.8 million in fiscal year 09. $11.8 million of that is, and $15.2 million of that in fiscal year 09 is for general administration of our statewide testing program. As you may know, we test in grades 3 through 8 in math and reading, grade 10 in reading, and grade 11 in math. We also we're starting administration of the grad test, which has replaced the basic skills test. In addition, we're also phasing out the basic skills test for those students that need to take retests that were part of the old state graduation requirement. $1.15 million is for the value-added index model. As many of you know, we are moving towards a student growth model. The reason for the delay in that is that we just started consecutive year testing in grades 3 through 8 in reading and math just this in 2006, and so we needed at least 2 years' worth of data in order to establish a full student growth model. Right now the state is in exploration of what that growth model will look like. I would really encourage members to attend a February 23rd meeting we're having. I know that invites have been distributed, but at this meeting we'll be looking at other states' growth models and taking feedback on what the state's growth model should look like. Just wanted to give that pitch for members. $2.34 million in fiscal year 08 and $3.5 million in fiscal year 09 is to develop a computer-based formative assessment. This would be voluntary for schools. As you know, the state's MCA assessment is summative, meaning we can give it at one point in time during the spring, and it is to measure students against the state standards in that particular grade. What this formative assessment would allow schools to do is use this assessment during the school year at their own use, and it would give them immediate feedback in subject areas for their students, and they could use that to make instructional decisions, real-time instructional decisions. This formative assessment would be voluntary. It would not be required, and the results of the formative assessment would not be reported to the state. It would be kept at the district level.
Ms. Anderson, in the governor's budget, I know that the governor has put forward a significant amount of one-time money for technology. Is any of that technology money earmarked to bring the schools up to speed who could not take advantage of this to make sure that they can? And could you address how many school districts in our state really wouldn't be able to do a computer-based test?
Madam Chair, the proposal that we have here, the only computer state computerized component of that is the retest of the graduation test. So those students that do not pass the grad test, we want to make sure ensure they have opportunities to retake that as many times as possible. And in order to do that, we need to computerize that grad test portion for the retakes. But that's dealing with a smaller segment of students, because right now about 85 to 90% of students will probably pass that grad test in the first time. The additional one-time funding for technology in the governor's budget is in a later article. One of the key things that we have found challenges to going online computerized for all of our assessments and for local assessments is just, first is the standards across the state are not even technology standards. Some have high-functioning technology. Others do not have that. We did issue a report, which I can certainly send to the committee members, looking at online testing and computerized testing. And the feedback from stakeholders is that we want to go there, but we don't have the capacity or resources right now to do so. So we know that will take a number of years to even get to full-scale computerized testing. We think that we need to be cautious about it. The governor's recommendation of $38 million is just a first step in that investment, first to get statewide technology standards across schools, and then also to build capacity through additional hardware, software, and lab capacity for schools to be able to do online testing. And so that is a potential use of that money for schools that have not been able to get up to speed to that because they have lack of funding or the resources haven't been allocated for those purposes. But we can talk about that bill language, too, when we get to that section.
Thank you. Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, my head doesn't calculate numbers as fast as we run through this. Lines 16 and 17, am I reading this correctly? We're going from 11.8 million to 15.2 million in just to continue the general administration and reporting of the tests. What percent increase is that?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, it's not to maintain existing services, it's to add additional services. That's why the additional money is needed. And in, for example, almost 2.4 million of that increase is just to go to an online computerized grad retest. So that students, right now, students, when they took the basic skills test, they took it at one point in time, and it was paper-pencil. So, for instance, the student had to wait to retake it until the state said, this is when we will give the administration of that test. Right now, what we're trying to do is move it for that segment of students that do not pass the first time to computerized, and then they can take it on demand at least six to eight weeks after they have failed the first or second chances. And what that will do is it will give students more opportunities to retake the test. And also for students, let's say a student just barely misses it. They maybe were a couple percentage points off or missed one answer and didn't make it. Probably that student would not meet a lot of remediation, could remediate in 6 weeks, could retake, and then pass it. Under the old system, they would have to wait months and months to have to retake it. And so what we're trying to do is, because we've moved this requirement to the high school tests, we need to find ways to provide enough opportunities for students to retake that test in order to graduate. The bulk of that increase is going to do that through an online grad test retest and to ensure those students can retake that test in a sufficient amount of opportunities.
Senator Rummel.
And vis-a-vis what you were just saying about the technology, do all schools have this technology so that students can access this online retesting?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, the reason why we're more comfortable going online with the grad retest is because we know we will be dealing with 10 to 15% of the student population and not 100%. And also they won't be retaking this test all at the same time. A student may retake the test in 6 to 8 weeks, or a student may retake the test a little bit longer because they may need no more work to remediate to be able to pass the test.
And so, members, we're talking about line 50 on your chart.
So we know that it's not going to be a bad rush of students that need to retake this test all at once. It's going to be a small segment of student population, and then within that population, they're not going to all retake it at the same time. In addition of that increase, we are recommending it's a classroom level re-rostering tool, and that's for teachers. Right now, it's very difficult for teachers to get the data, the teacher data information from their statewide assessment, to analyze it, to look at where their students are at. What this would do, it's called the perspective system, and it allows the teacher a secure web-based access to go into, pull up their students' assessment data, review it. It's right there on hand. They can re-roster the file. They can take a look at that. They can add information, and it will provide teachers with more information quicker than having to wait for paper files or wait for an Excel spreadsheet. And so that's why we're asking for this additional money. It's not to maintain the status quo. It's to do some additional things we think is necessary to enhance our statewide assessment program.
Thank you.
Ms. Anderson, are any of those measures going to affect the test results being given to our parents and schools faster?
Madam Chair, that's one of the difficult issues that we deal with. As you know, we had a November release this year because two things happened. One, we increased the number of tests. We now test in grades 4, 6, and 8. We used to just test in grades 3, 5, and 7 in reading and math. And then we also changed the standards in 2003, and the new tests reflected the change in standards. So a number of standard setting and processes had to occur in order to ensure that the tests were aligned and the scores were accurate. Generally, our release is going to be in the mid-summer release. And one of the struggles we have with release date is that we are required to put constructed responses onto the test. And constructed responses require a hand scoring. And that takes time. If we did not have constructed responses on our tests, we could turn around the results much quicker. We do go through a number of quality procedures before we release test scores, and we think that's very important because we do not want to have inaccurate data. Schools receive sanctions, receive ratings. These scores are used for, in cases of the grad test, for graduation. And the last thing that we would want is a scoring error. And so we do a check on the data, the vendor does a check on the data, and we have a third-party reviewer that also checks that data. In addition, we have to equate the scores, and we bring in teachers to take a look at that to set the cut score, basically. What's going to be the level of proficiency for each test? And so those things take at least 3 weeks for us to go through that process. And then when you add constructed response to that, that has to be hand-scored separately, and we have to wait for those results. And so as we move forward, I think it's a policy issue to consider is, number one, what value does the constructed response have for the testing system? And number two, if we did remove that, we would have to transition out of constructed responses, but it would, in the end, give results back to teachers and schools much quicker.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, when they are allowed to do the retakes, are any of those scores then put into that release in midsummer, or will they be planned? And what would be your cutoff so that if they are, that they would be included?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I'm going to have Dirk Mattson answer that. It's more of a technical question.
Mr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Senator, the plan for that graduation computerized retest will probably be the first time, if I take the test as a 10th grader, I'm taking it on paper with the regular administration. Once I get those results back, it would probably start early in the summer, maybe even before school is out, as far as if I did not pass. And there's actually two chances to pass the test for that paper-based. One is on the MCA-2 for No Child Left Behind. If you're proficient, you're good to go. If you take the retest, of that grad portion we've tucked inside there. If you pass that, you're good to go. If neither of those work for you in that spring administration, then immediately following that summer, you'd have available the computer, and we would have those results, we say, relatively quickly. We might give a preliminary, here's what you got for a raw score, right there as soon as you finish the computerized test. I'm always reluctant, as Commissioner Anderson has said, to say we will give you immediate results, because we want a human to verify the computer did it correctly, because this is a very high-stakes test. So they will be very quick. Within 48 hours, we would be able to have an official document to the student or to the school. But then again, as was mentioned, every 6 to 8 weeks after that, that student would be able to go back and retake. And the purpose of that 6 to 8 weeks is to force some remediation so they don't go back on Tuesday and, you know, Nintendo, and here we go, let's see if we can hit the right answers. There's some actual reason for requiring that student to go back and look at what they didn't perform on well, and that those results would be available immediately as well.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And then cumulatively, all the student test scores, when will that cutoff be so that when they originally take the paper test, the release in midsummer that reflects the cumulative scores of all the students in that school, will that include the retakes up to a certain point?
Mr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you. I understand your question. Once the retests start, we don't anticipate. Right now we have what we produce for on a standard administration, a summary report. Here's how your students who retested did on the February administration or in the July administration. Once those kids get into this retest administration mode, we don't anticipate sending out a summary score for the grad retests. We can certainly pull that data together. We're able to do that. But because we're giving districts and students such flexibility of taking the test when they need to, it would be hard to pick a point in time and say that's the summary. So there certainly would be just as we do now, an initial passing rate, and the commissioner mentioned that roughly on the BST between 80% to 90%, depending on which test we're talking about, past that, and that would likely still be reported as far as here's the initial administration of your 10th graders, 11th graders, and this is how many students passed. And then once we get into that retest mode, and we don't necessarily do that even now with the BST, we don't report summary results of retest because it's a very fluid population.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has this discussion applied only to retaking for graduation purposes, or does this apply to the MCAs? Because what I sense that Senator Roebling is talking about is that scores that apply to the schools affect these star ratings, and if in fact you're retaking, are they adjusted so that it would accommodate those changes and that it might affect their overall ranking?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Senator. Yeah, the grad test does not impact the star ratings and so forth. That's a Minnesota requirement, student-level requirement for graduation. So those scores do not impact in any way, shape, or form the star rating, the school report card, et cetera. It may be reported on there as far as a percentage, but again, it's not part of that star rating. So the graduation test is kind of in its own separate column, if you will. Retests for the MCA2s are done during the testing window. So districts have 3 weeks to which they can set the calendar, and if students are absent during the time when the rest of the fifth grade takes the exam, those students then, when they get back in the building during that 3 weeks, they can retest, or excuse me, it's not retest, but just make up the exam during that three-week portion. So we collect all the scores for the students who are in the accountability system that are contributing to the report card and star system at the same time. There isn't a retest later on for those kids.
Thank you.
And Dr. Mattson, with this new system of teachers being able to go online and look at data, would it be possible for teachers to access the computerized part or the hand, you know, the machine scored part of the test results earlier than when everything is completed and those results are sent in the summer?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we do currently give preliminary results out to the school districts earlier than they are reported in the paper. I will tell you one caution. We've actually explored this in years past with stakeholders about would you like just the multiple choice early, and we'll get you the constructed response later on and add them in and show you what it is. there's two sides to this. I mean, that's a good thing. I got my results right away. But, for example, the 11th grade math test, it's about a quarter of the assessment is that test. So I'm really getting only a partial picture of how my students performed without the constructed response. There are roughly 20 points available. If I have that number right, yes, 20 points available in the 11th grade test that are part of constructed response. So if I get only 75% of the answers back on how my students did, I'm not going to, it's an incomplete picture. So there's two sides to it. It may be helpful to me, but the constructed response and the total score is really what we're going to be after. And I've advocated since I've taken the position that really the piece, and I think to the senator's question, the piece is to get information and tools to teachers prior to those summative results instead of trying to essentially kind of force in getting the faster results on the summative if we're talking about affecting instruction. It's doing the parts, doing the work on the front side, and that's part of what we've have in that recommendation.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just a brief comment, just so folks understand. The basic skills test was given in grade 8, and as we were looking at the 8th grade, there was a lot of testing that was going to happen in that grade, and there was concern that the high school test was not taken as seriously or as accountable to students. And so the 2005 legislature repealed the basic skills test and to eliminate basically two administrations of test, state administrations of testing. And included in the high school MCAs is the grad test. So you have two tests in one, basically. And a subset of questions in the grad test or in the MCA 2s is the grad test. Those students do not know that. We do not identify that on the test. This is the grad portion. And so it was really an effort to try to get students to take that test more seriously because I knew that a subset of those questions were going to be required for state graduation. And that was really the twofold purpose. One was to eliminate test administrations by the state, so there's two less tests we're giving in grade 8. And another one was to get some more accountability, or student accountability around the high school test, because that's one thing our principals and high school teachers told us was that we can't get a lot of our high school students to take these tests seriously. So that was the rationale behind the change that was made. And what we're trying to accomplish here in this budget proposal is going with online retests of only that subset of questions. They wouldn't retake the whole MCA 2. They would only retake the subset of questions if they failed the first time. And being able to provide enough opportunities for students to have that retake and provide more flexibility for school districts to administer the retakes when they felt it was appropriate versus telling them exactly what date they will take the retest.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, next section reflect that we have not discussed is subdivision 16, which is the collaborative urban educator. The governor is recommending a $771,000 increase each year for this program. This is a program that is run through Concordia, St. Thomas, and Winona State University that trains minority teachers in. The goal is to train and put more minority teachers into our urban and other school districts around the state. So they have that's their stated goal of the programming. Subdivision 19 is a slight base adjustment for the Educational Planning and Assessment Program. This is a program that was started in 2005. It's voluntary. It's part of the ACT program. Students take an assessment in eighth grade to judge their strengths and weaknesses as they look at college readiness. And then they take an assessment in 10th grade that looks at the predictability of how they will perform on the ACT. We're very excited. This is a voluntary assessment, and we had nearly 100% participation in 10th grade and about 80% participation in eighth grade. And in order to accommodate 100% of schools that want to do this, the governor is requesting a slight base adjustment. Madam Chair.
Ms. Anderson, can you tell us what is that slight base adjustment?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nelman.
The base for this program is $829,000, and it increases to $1.293 million. So over the biennium, we're looking at about $928,000 increase.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, subdivision 28 has been adjusted by the amendment. $1.9 million is stated here, but the amendment that was adopted brings it in line to $1.1 million per year. And that's it for Article 2. Article 3, Dr. Melcher is going to provide testimony to the committee on.
Hello, Dr. Melcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. Article 3 is beginning on page 41 of the bill. The governor has four essential recommendations regarding special education funding. And those four recommendations, if you are following along on your spreadsheet, they appear, the fiscal impact appears on line 77 through line 90 of the spreadsheet. You'll see a total of $36.7 million being added to the biennium. That is the result of $35.3 million coming from a 2% increase in each year of the biennium in the regular special education funding, the excess cost funding, and the transition disabled funding. And there's also a transfer of $1.4 million from a separate categorical for Part C programs into the regular special education funding piece. So of the $36 million you see there, the $36.7 million, $35.3 is new money, and the other $1.4 is a transfer from another section of the budget. In addition to the two and two on the special education formulas, the governor is recommending that the funding for special education be converted from a second prior year basis to a current funding basis to better align the costs and the funding and to make the excess cost formula more stable. Governor is also recommending to combine the caps for the special education regular and the transition disabled accounts in order to ensure that we have consistent funding for staff that are included in the special education regular program and the transition disabled program. And the governor's recommending that the funding for Part C expansion be included in the regular and special education accounts rather than being carried in a separate categorical.
And Dr. Melcher, could you talk for a moment about the change to the from the past year funding to the current year? I understand in the past there's been an opinion that that would be difficult for school districts to make that change, and now it is included in the governor's recommendation. Can you address that, please?
Madam Chair and members, thank you. The special education funding historically was based on a current year basis. I think it was in the mid-90s that we converted to a second prior year funding basis. I think in part the change that was made in the mid-90s was an effort to try to create a cost containment feature by basically making the districts wait 2 years to get reimbursed for their special education costs. However, that has created some inequities in the system, especially for districts that have rapidly growing costs or changes where they have new children moving into the district that have special needs. Using second prior year data does allow us to finalize the aid calculations earlier in the year. However, the school districts, I believe, do have a good sense of what staff they've hired. They're paying them, and they know who they've got on board, and so we don't believe it will be an overwhelming problem for school districts to use current year data. We've also had a lot of concerns raised by school districts about the instability of our excess cost system. And one of the primary things that leads to instability in the excess cost funding is that we have a mismatch between the second prior year funding for the regular special ed formula and the current year funding for the excess cost formula. So if you have a district that has a large increase in their special education cost, for example, the regular funding doesn't kick in for 2 years, and so the excess cost funding spikes upward to accommodate that increase. And then 2 years later, when the regular funding reflects that cost that occurred, the excess cost funding goes back down again, so the excess cost funding is going like this because of the mismatch between the 2 years. And if we align the the funding so that the regular special ed funding and the excess cost funding are both for the same year, we think that the excess cost piece, which has been very difficult for districts to budget, will be more stable and predictable.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, with kind of that general overview, then I'd like to walk through the sections and explain where these changes are being made. Article 3, Section 1 on page 43, line 33 of the bill is reflecting the change from the second prior year base revenue to the current year for the transportation portion of the special education funding. Sections 2 and 3 on pages 44 and 45 are making the conversion from the base year to the current year funding for the transition disabled program. Section 4 on page 46, line 7, is incorporating the funding for the expansion of Part C into the regular special education funding system. And, Madam Chair, if I could provide a little background on that, the U.S. Office of Education visited the Department of Education here about a year ago and determined that the current Minnesota rules were not sufficient to include all of the children that the federal law and regulations require to be included in Part C. We had been including children 0 to 2 if they had two areas of developmental delay, and the federal regulations required that some additional children be served if they had, for example, one area of developmental delay, or if they had conditions that were indicating that they were likely to need service. And so our rule is currently being amended. The legislature last year provided a separate sort of a placeholder, like a $400,000 piece for this expansion of Part C. In order to keep the funding system efficient, it is appropriate for that additional money, rather than being a separate piece out on the side, to be incorporated in with the existing funding for special education. We're currently serving a number of students that are birth to two, and these new students coming in would be served by the same staff. And so it just doesn't make sense to have a categorical to fund for part of a person's salary and then have the regular special ed cover the rest of it. And so the governor's recommended that funding be rolled into the regular special education funding. So there's no net impact on the state. It's a transfer from a categorical into the main special education system to most efficiently serve these kids and avoid additional paperwork for the school districts. Section 5 of the bill and Section 6 on page 47 are making the conversion from base year funding to current year funding for the regular special education account. You can see there's some stricken language, and those were some extra features that were needed because of the base year that are being eliminated. So another advantage of moving from base year to current year funding is that we've eliminated some of the need to make adjustments between the second prior year and the current year. So, for example, now we're calculating the funding based on second prior year data, and then we make an adjustment for change in ADM between the 2 years. But if we're calculating based on the current year data, we don't need to make that adjustment any longer. Section 7 of the bill is the caps for special education. These are being increased by 2% the first year and an additional 2% the second year.
Dr. Melcher, do you have any concern about the distributional impact of making this change?
Madam Chair, there will conceivably be a distributional impact between using second prior year data and current year data. We do not have solid data in terms of exactly what that will be, because we don't know what the districts will be spending for special education in 2008 and 2009. So there will be some change, but it's not something that we can simulate. And what we believe is that it will be more equitable and accurate to base the funding on the current year data rather than what the district spent 2 years ago. So to the extent there is a redistribution, it will be in the direction of making the funding more closely reflect the actual cost in the current year rather than what the districts were spending 2 years earlier.
Thank you. Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Melchior, can you give me some background on the caps, the history of our special ed caps, and how that's affecting our special ed funding in general?
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, the caps went into place in the mid-90s, and up until the 2003 legislative session, there were annual inflation adjustments provided in the special education funding. During the 2003 special education 2003 session, the caps for special education funding were removed, so we have not been providing inflation for the last couple of years in terms of the special education funding, and under current law, we would not be providing inflation in the future. And that has resulted in an increase of roughly $50 million a year in the what we call the cross subsidy, in other words, the amount of money that school districts are taking from their general, unreserved general fund to cover the unfunded costs of special education.
And Dr. Melcher, you had said the caps were removed, but I believe what you meant to say is the growth factor was removed.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes,
thank you.
It's the caps were fixed at a fixed dollar amount, so the growth was removed. So we have a situation where the funding is flat and the cost is growing about 4.5% a year, and that's contributing to an increase in the unfunded portion of the special education cost. So we've just published a cross-subsidy report showing the amount for each school district that they were essentially transferring from the general education program to special education to cover the unfunded cost, and that was about $416 million in fiscal year 05. And we're projecting that for the current year, that's about $518 million. So roughly a $100 million increase over 2 years in the amount that districts are transferring from the general fund to cover unfunded special education cost.
And members, I've asked staff to bring those reports to the next meeting so we'll be able to see how it impacts our districts. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I hope you don't mind. I just wanted to recognize there's a group of students here from a charter school in my district in St. Paul from the Jennings Charter School who are here listening in and trying to learn something about our education budget, which is quite complicated. So I just wanted to welcome them.
Thank you, Senator Anderson, and welcome students. Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, the caps that you see on page 49, lines 1 through 5, are being increased by 2% each year, and then in addition to that, the money that's being transferred from the separate categorical for Part C is also being added to those figures. As I said, the cost is growing about 4.5% a year. The caps are growing at 2.5% a year. So we're reducing the growth in the cross subsidy, but we're not eliminating it with this.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, is the growth occurring because of more students coming into special ed, or is it mainly a factor of salaries for the program itself?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, that's a very good question. It's some of both, actually. While our overall student population has been stable and actually declining slightly, the number of students with disabilities has been growing. So in the 2003 school year, for example, we had 113,000 students with disabilities. Now we have 117,500 this year. So we've had an increase of 4,500 in the last 4 years. And we've also seen some changes in the types of students that we're seeing, particularly in the area of autism, for example, where some of the more expensive students' categories have seen some increases. So there's been a combination of more students with disabilities, more students in high-cost categories as opposed to low-cost categories, and then also we have the salary inflation that you would see in other areas of the budget as well.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, have you calculated that the percentage of increase as it compares with the percentage change in the overall student population? What percentage of special ed in relation to our total population and how, if that also is increasing? I don't know what the fluctuation is of of our overall population right now?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I don't have the exact figures with me, but the percentage has been increasing. I think we're currently a little bit over 13%, and if you go back a few years, we were around 11 or 12%. So there has been an increase in the percentage of students with disabilities. Madam Chair, moving to Section 8 of the bill, again, this is the stricken language is eliminating some extra complicating factors that were needed when we had base year funding that would no longer be needed for a current year funding system. For example, currently, if it's a charter school in the first 4 years of operation, they were funded on current year data, where school districts were funded on second prior year data. So, again, this makes the system a little bit more uniform by having the school districts and the new charter schools all on the same current year basis. Section 9 of the bill is dealing with special education maintenance of effort. We had language similar to this in last year's bill. This would ensure that in the future, in the event that the state special education aid were to go down under the forecast, that we would, in fact, provide an adjustment in the special education account to ensure that it remained flat and that we would not be penalized by the federal government for maintenance of effort.
And, Dr. Melcher, wasn't there some concern previously by the Department of Finance that to put this language into the statute could cause some problems for us?
Madam Chair, I don't recall there being an issue of that sort. I believe that a finance department in the last legislative session wanted to have the language uncodified in order that this would have a fuller discussion as part of the regular biennial budget process during the 2007 legislative session. And what we've done here is made this section effective for fiscal year 2010. Given the 2 and 2 increase that the governor's recommending, we know that the state will be maintaining effort for the current biennium. However, the 2 and 2 increase recommended in special education is not a permanent 2% every year into the future. It's 2% for 08, 2% for 09, and then the funding would be flat for 10 and 11, just like the general ed formula is flat. So this is protecting us that in the event that the 2009 legislature decided not to increase special education funding for 2010 and 2011, that we would have a minimum floor that would prevent us from being penalized for failing to maintain effort. Turning to Section 10 on page 50, line 27 of the bill, there's a change in the excess cost formula, again related to using current year data. Currently, we have two alternative excess cost formulas, which just adds to the complexity. The second formula, which is being stricken, is really a protection for those districts that have had a rapid increase between the base year and the current year. And since we would be moving to current year funding, we can eliminate the need to have two different formulas in the excess cost area. Section 11 is the caps for the special education excess cost. And those are being increased by 2% each year, plus the amount that's being moved in from the Part C calculation that otherwise would have been a separate categorical. Section 12 is a technical amendment clarifying the calculation of the out-of-state tuition, just being more specific in terms of the categories of general education revenue that are used in that calculation. And then Section 13 is the appropriations, which reflect the 2 and 2 increases that I've described and the base level funding for all of the other areas. And Section 14 is the repealer. And this is repealing some of the subdivisions that were necessary to do the base cost adjustments when we had the base funding system that would no longer be necessary when we moved to current funding of special education costs.
Any questions on this, members? Senator Wieger.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, are there any reports that you can recommend that could be eliminated or reduced that would increase the efficiency of more teacher-student contact time in special ed? And do you have an estimate as to what that percentage of time is right now?
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, I do not have that information with me. I would have to visit with our special education director, Barbara Trulene, to get that. But we could research that and get back to you on that.
Madam Chair, Dr. Melcher, the issue is raised usually every session. So hopefully there may be some suggestions on that topic.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, if I could add just one comment.
Ms. Anderson.
In late 2004, the federal government reauthorized the Special Education Act, or IDEA Act. And right now, the department is meeting with stakeholders on revising the state, taking recommendations and suggestions for revising the state rules as it relates to special education. And those meetings are going to happen in March. And based on those meetings, we'll come forward with recommendations for changes to our rules. But first, we want to engage our stakeholders first in that process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, moving to Article 4 of the budget, Facilities and Technology. Section 1 of the bill is relating to the calculation of the debt service levies, and it is eliminating an exemption for job zone property. We currently have a fairly complicated system where job zone properties are excluded from the non-bonded portion of debt levies, but they're included in the bonded debt portion of debt levies. The non-bonded portion of debt levies is very small, but the exclusion from this one piece creates a tremendous amount of additional calculations that are needed for the department and for county auditors, and it makes it very difficult for school districts to understand how their property tax levies are being calculated for the debt service fund. We've done some analysis, and there's virtually no net impact of all of these calculations. There's such a small amount of job zone property, and where it's located, there's almost no debt service aid being generated anyway, so we're going through a series of machinations to get to a number here. And that we feel we could significantly simplify the calculations for debt service aid by simply saying all of the levies in the debt service fund, if it's job zone property, they have to pay those. Earlier, when we talked about Article 1, we had another piece where we were suggesting a simplification on old operating referendum levies, where we said the job zones are currently exempt from are not exempt from certain of those. So we've kind of got two things that offset each other a little bit, but the net impacts are extremely small. We're talking, you know, changes of $2,000 or $3,000 in individual districts, and greatly simplifying the funding calculations. And sections one of the bill deals with that issue. Section two of the bill is also relating to that issue, and it's moving the equalization for the alternative facilities levy for pay-as-you-go districts to the health and safety formula. There's no fiscal impact of this because none of the districts that have these levies actually qualifies for aid under either the debt service formula or the health and safety formula. It just lines up the calculations to make them more simple and straightforward. And then Section 3 is also relating to this job zone issue.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to see if my brain was working. Does this mean the job Z zones, they will be paying for the referendum and debt service levies, or they won't be? You made it consistent, but which way? That they will pay rather than not pay?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the job zones will pay for all of the levies in the debt service fund. Currently, they're paying for the bonded debt, which is the great bulk of them, but they're not paying for other non-bonded debt in the debt service fund, which is primarily energy loans that occurred before 1998. On the operating referendum side, currently they are paying for referendums before 2004. They're not paying for referendums after 2004. And the change would be that they wouldn't pay for any of the referendums. So on the debt service side, we're adding a very tiny amount to the burden on the job zones. On the operating referendum side, we're removing a little bit of the burden from them. It's basically a wash, and the state total is like under $50,000 statewide, and it has almost no net impact and just creates quite a bit of simplification in the calculations.
Thank you. It's clear now. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Section 4 is the school technology grant funding. The governor is recommending $33 million for this program. As I discussed earlier, it's a grant program to be distributed on an equitable geographical basis, and it's to develop minimum uniform technology standards, development of policies and procedures that assure instructional resource availability to help students and teachers, development of databases that may be necessary to be accessible within each district, and development of policies, procedures, and systems that support teachers and student learning. This funding is it's basically done on an application basis based on needs. If you look, priorities given to those that have attempted to get additional funding for technology but have failed, previous attempts to participate in online opportunities, and effective ability to engage community stakeholders. Because as we look at technology, in fact, we work very closely with the Office of Enterprise Technology on a broadband initiative. We know that broadband capacity is not just in schools, but can be connected to different private businesses and higher education. And so we know that we want to make sure that we're being efficient when we look at expanding technology in our communities and also in our schools. This funding is one-time money, as money is available for schools. And as I said, it's done on a grant application basis. Section 5 of the bill is online learning expansion grants. This is $5 million for startup money for school districts looking to start up or enhance existing online learning opportunities. As you may know, we have had in 2003 and in 2005, we did provide a funding for online learning through our general education program. This would allow schools and school districts looking to start up programs, which can be very costly, initially to start up an online learning program because of the number of things you have to do in order to be compliant with law and alignment with standards. This would allow monies for those school districts to engage in that process and have funding to start up those programs.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Anderson, could you relate the goal of online by 09 to the technology and this section and where we're at?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger. Online by 09 was a goal set in 2004, wanting to go with online state testing. We had a committee that looked at that issue and recommended that 09 was not a realistic goal, that they needed additional resources to expand lab capacity in order to meet that goal, and also there needed to be some sort of minimum standards across districts in order to deliver state tests online. And so, you know, as I said, we will give that report to this committee to take a look at. I think it was a very thorough report done with the department, with our stakeholders in school districts and charter schools. But at this point, we need to first look at infusing additional resources, which this recommendation does, to first minimally establish statewide standards for technology. That is the biggest hindrance to moving forward with statewide online testing. Is the fact that the standards across schools is not the same. There's not a minimum standard, and it's very difficult to deliver that testing program when the standards are all different across a system. And I can certainly make that, like I said, that report available to you and members of the committee.
Ms. Anderson, with regard to your online learning section, is part of the reason for this $5 million number that there's a shortage of curriculum for online learning? What is the makeup of that $5 million?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what happens is that schools would like to, particular rural schools, want to develop more online courses for their students and to provide more opportunities for courses, especially at the high school level, for their students. And what happens is if a student can't access it in the school district, they have to go to another school district, and then that resident school district loses a portion of that student's aid because of that. And so what we have is an interest of particular rural school districts to develop programming within their district to meet the needs of their students rather than to go to another district.
Thank you. And Commissioner Anderson, if you go back to the development of uniform technology standards, a follow-up on what Senator Wieger was asking with regard to online by 09, does the development of uniform technology standards deal with hardware, deal with infrastructure, deal with the ability to for all of our schools to have high speed? Talk a little bit more about what are we going to be accomplishing with the development of standards.
Madam Chair, my name is Kathy Wagner. I'm the IT director for the Department of Education. I think the biggest hindrance to delivering online testing as well as online learning is a lack of uniformity and connectivity, internet connectivity across schools, as well as hardware, basic hardware that is not up to speed, and actually the number of machines that are in schools. So it's kind of a threefold piece. We want to make sure that everybody has sufficient internet speed to be able to access current software packages in the form of testing and online learning. We also need to make sure that there are enough machines in school so that students can access them during a normal course of instruction, and that the operating systems are at a level that will allow them to interact with those packages as well. So this bill is looking at providing additional funding so that schools can purchase infrastructure upgrades to be able to access programs that are recommended and supported by MDE.
So will the outcome of this particular effort lead us to a base requirement? Will we say that all school districts at a minimum have to have a certain standard of technology in their classroom, and will there be an intent on behalf of the department to have funding associated with that?
Madam Chair, we would like to convene a committee of stakeholders, including technical experts as well as constituents in the schools and their technical experts, to better understand exactly what the infrastructure issues are. But we can also tell by looking at the current software packages, for example, the online testing systems that are being proposed, what the technical requirements are. So we would be bringing that information to that stakeholder group, and I believe together we would come up with some minimum operating standards and some minimum connectivity issues that would be developed into minimum statewide technical standards for schools in order to access MDE programs.
Thank you. And Ms. Anderson, how many school districts are currently offering online learning?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're really going to have to go back and get that information. We approve providers of online services at the department as part of the law. So not every school district has to become a certified provider before they can access general education revenue for programming. I know we at least have 10 providers of that, and that occurs normally through school districts. They do it one of two ways. They enroll students in their school district and deliver it around the state, or a school district in themselves may be delivering within their own school district but not outside of that school district. So there's a number of formats that happens, and we can certainly get that information to the committee.
Senator Rummel and then Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Possibly I missed something. This is $5 million of one-time money to create the standard, to come up with this minimum standard. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, actually the $33 million is for the resources to school districts to help bring their technology up to minimum standards and for additional capacity for things like online assessments. The $5 million is only for the online learning piece.
All right.
Senator Wieger.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Anderson, as a part of the online providers, someone asked me about the Blue Sky online learning service and may have the title incorrect, but if we could get information on their background and track record as well, if they are a provider.
Okay. Madam Chair, we'll get that information.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Anderson. I just was curious about a comment you made that that some districts may be hesitant to encourage online that isn't developed within their own system because they have to pay for for those services. Did you say that? And I'm just wondering what happens as we start encouraging in our secondary schools more online services. And I guess I want to make sure that we don't have each district trying to develop its own programs because they're worried about the funding issue. I'm just wondering how this is all going to work so that we have a kind of a coordinated system and not everybody's trying to redo what other districts are doing.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher. The way that the online learning funding works is that if a student is enrolled in a school district that is providing online learning, then it's just the regular general education funding. They're enrolled, for example, it could open enroll to the Houston School District, which has a very large online program. The money just flows to the Houston School District like any other school district, any other student who's open enrolled into another district on a full-time basis. So for students that are taking online courses from the school district they're enrolled in, it's just regular funding according to the general formula. If the student is enrolled in one school district and they're taking a class in another school district through online, then the system works like post-secondary enrollment options, where we're taking the number of hours that the student is out of the regular district programming, taking, let's say they're in a six-hour day and they're taking 1 hour from an online provider in another district. We give the enrolling district 12% of the money for kind of overhead, and then 88% of the money follows to the district that's providing the online services. So if you are a student enrolled in Lake of the Woods and you were taking an online course from the Houston School District for 1 hour, you would be basically getting 88% of 1/6 of the money flowing to that district, just like post-secondary enrollment options.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So I'm wondering if we can develop a plan somehow so that I know it's probably going to happen. Each district will want to keep the money in their own district, and will be trying to develop their own or trying to develop programs which other districts will tap into so they can get the extra revenue. How can we coordinate that so that we don't have people duplicating efforts and spending a lot of resources in that effort?
Madam Chair,
Deputy Commissioner.
It's not our intention to duplicate effort, but rather some school districts in rural areas have unique needs. For instance, they may not be able to hire a science teacher at the high school for a particular area, like a chemistry teacher or a physics teacher, and they need to deliver courses, but they can develop it on their own rather than trying to seek out different courses and figure out how that will work. And so it's not the intention that we want to duplicate effort, but rather is provide some startup funding, and this is not permanent funding, it's just startup funding to meet some of those needs that are happening particularly in rural Minnesota. And in addition to some of the school districts that have online courses, they not only reach out to their own public students, but they're also reaching out to homeschool students. That's a big population of students that are entering into online programs in the public school system, also to other non-publics that may not be able to offer courses. And so we're seeing a more expansive population of students that are opting into online learning, not just the public school students.
And Deputy Commissioner, isn't there a provision already in law to certify online learning courses?
Madam Chair, as I said before, we certify the program, so they cannot access the general fund dollars unless it's a certified provider.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So, in some ways, the department could control the number of programs that become certified so that we don't have an over-proliferation of them. Could that happen?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that's correct. They have to meet certain criteria in the law before they become a certified provider. We have rejected a number of applicants that have wanted to be providers because they haven't met the standards or the quality that's expected in the statute. So to some extent, we already do that, and we have that authority. Madam Chair, and going through the rest of the bill, those are this baseline appropriations for the remaining appropriations in Section 6, and so we'll move on to Article 5 if you wish. Article 5, Section 1 is the governor's language for his 70% in the classroom proposal. This is not a direct mandate that schools must set aside 70%, but rather it's a goal that the district should achieve, and every school board must formally adopt a minimum percent they plan to use for operating expenditures to allocate to direct classroom expenditures. And so at this point, it's not a mandate. It's a reporting requirement for school boards to undertake.
And Deputy Commissioner Anderson, what's the thinking, given it's not a mandate, of including it in this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it was either going into this bill or the policy bill. And so we decided to insert this into the policy bill because it was probably the best place, or I'm sorry, into the budget bill, because we figured it was the best place in talking about expenditures of funds.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, it looks like it doesn't specify a percent in this version. It just says that they have to adopt a percent. The board just decides what percent they think is appropriate, and then they have to adopt that.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, you are correct. Madam Chair, going on to the Section 2 appropriations, this is baseline funding for programmings under
Senator
this article.
Senator Scheid, excuse me.
Madam Chair, when I saw the nutrition, I didn't think that I was in the right place, and so I was looking around. At
Senator Scheid, I had the same.
Okay, I'm sorry. Madam Chair and Ms. Anderson, give us the kind of the laundry list or sort of a fundamental list of what's included up here? It looks like it might be a little different from what the governor has talked about or what districts have thought were not included. I'm talking about, you know, back in campaign kind of stuff, and when we talked about that 70%, districts talked to us about things that they believed were not included, and I'm wondering what is included here, if you could.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I'm going to have Dr. Melcher explain what's included in a classroom expenditure.
Madam Chair and members, on page 60, line 25 of the bill, there's the definition of direct classroom expenditures that includes instructional expenditures under UFARS, excluding tuition payments to other Minnesota school districts, capital expenditures, and expenditures for athletics, co-curricular, and extracurricular activities. So this is direct classroom instruction. It excludes what we call instructional support and pupil support. So in other words, the guidance counselors and librarians are not included in this definition. This is only essentially direct classroom teachers, teacher aides, instructional materials and supplies, things that are in the regular classroom and does not include the support services that are provided to students through the media center or the guidance counselors or social workers and so forth. The denominator in the calculation, the total expenditures, excludes tuition payments to other districts and excludes pupil transportation and capital expenditures. The governor was concerned about how this would affect rural districts versus urban districts, and so did not want to include the transportation expenditures, which were included in some of the kind of national work that's been done on this issue, kind of out of the notion that for rural school districts, if you included transportation, it would be more difficult to get to a target level because they have to spend more just to get the kids to the door.
Dr. Melcher, I would like to say for the record that many school districts object to the service providers not being included in part of this, particularly the counselors, the school nurses, the social workers, given that we all know that to have a student ready to learn, it takes many, many people in today's environment to support that student. And so I do know that the schools have been concerned that those people are not included in this, who do have such direct impact, particularly things like the media center, when they spend time in the media center taking classes, doing their work.
Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I could just ask one more question then, Dr. Melcher. What about I understand if you had computers in every classroom or in some classrooms, that would count as classroom instruction. But what if you have a computer lab and a technology person who provides the kind of instruction that some kids get in the classroom? Is that support or is that counted as classroom?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, the capital expenditures are excluded from both the numerator and denominator, so the computers that would be purchased for a computer lab are not included either in the numerator or denominator in the calculation. If you had a teacher who was teaching in, let's say it was a kind of a business office sort of a course, that would be included, kind of a career technical sort of program. But if it was a lab technician who was making sure the computers work, that would not be included in this.
Senator Saltzman and then Senator Olson.
Yes. On your point, Madam Chair and Dr. Melcher, if we go back to page 24 and the governor's proposals regarding high school reform, I look at most of the page, and to me, I believe, had a discussion about this in the Education Policy Committee on the importance of guidance counselors and support staff, and talked to, I believe Mrs. Knuth, who is with the secondary school principals, and asked what kind of impact that these support staff, and I think they're beyond support staff, have on the achievement of our young people. So I see a little bit of a disconnect here between eliminating some of these. I guess I would propose that if we want to look at this kind of initiative, that maybe school districts be able to list the services that are included when they determine a certain percentage, because some schools might use technology more. And we've certainly heard a lot of discussion about that. So I think it's an interesting proposal. I think the public should know where we're putting our resources. But when we're saying one thing and then not counting a whole page of a program in that particular percentage, I am concerned.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, this is a little bit different base, particularly with the denominator, than we've seen in the past. When we've had these discussions of whether you mandate a particular percentage for the classroom. Have you or will you be doing the runs for the based on the current expenditures, so that we could get an idea of how that plays out now? Because I think what's different, and we've been focusing in during the election season talking about the 70%. Mm-hmm. What is actually healthy to the dialogue is if you look at what what is included, what percent does that meet of the total that we're including in the denominator within that total, and then it also gives you a chance to communicate what's in the remaining percentage, because you are taking out certain things that's we would throw in the as you said, the transportation and all of these things that are great variables. I think that could be a helpful communication as to what's in the classroom, what's in terms of the support. We all know that virtually everything is done is related to instruction. Mm-hmm. So it would be I think it would be helpful for us to see the example of how this applies now as to whether this would appear to be a useful exercise within a school district, since we aren't telling mm-hmm. them what they have to do. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter for them to look at their own situation and identify what they may be striving to do based on what their current efforts are, if they're satisfied with those or whether they want to change it, and also a tool to communicate what's in the, whether it's 60 or what, 5 or 70, 80 or whatever, mm-hmm. and what's in the 20 in terms of helping people understand where the money goes. So it looks like you've kind of gone away from it having to be a, something that's hard and fast, and rather it could be a means of communicating more effectively with their public. But it would be helpful to us, I think, to see how this new calculation would be, if it were applied right now, what it would tell us.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the calculations that are shown here are the same calculations that were included in the governor's initial proposal during the last legislative session. Initially, the proposal was to have the 70% as a fixed level, but the numerator and denominator in these calculations are the same as the governor used in the 70% calculation. Now, those are different from, I think, what had been talked about the previous legislative year, and also what has been in some of the national media as far as a 65% rule. I think what the governor did was to look at the 65% rule that has been talked about nationally, and in that particular calculation, they included transportation. And I think the governor was sensitive to the issue of transportation, including that not being fair to rural districts, and so that was part of what led to taking transportation out and then adjusting to the 70% level. Oh, and food service is another one that is a similar sort of situation. So we have excluded it here. I think in the national piece it may be included. We do have the information published on our website for fiscal year 2004, which was part of the governor's proposal last session. We would have newer data available if committee members would like to see how this would play out with newer data.
Senator Hahn, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Melcher. Just going back to line 60.25 and the definition, direct classroom expenditures, and I confess I don't recall my detailed knowledge of UFARs, but in the UFARs construction, are there categories that are already classified as direct classroom expenditures? In other words, are we taking things from UFARs that are already defined as direct classroom expenditures, or are we creating through this a category of line items and designating it as direct classroom expenditures?
Madam Chair and
Dr. Melcher
and Senator Hahn, the definition here of direct classroom expenditures varies a little bit from what we use in UFARs. UFARs has a definition just called instruction.
Okay.
And the differences are that instruction under UFARs includes the athletics and co-curriculars. And I think the governor's view was those are taking place outside of the regular classroom, and so we've got this broader label of instruction overall, and then when this narrowed that down to look at only classroom instruction, and so the athletic piece and the co-curriculars got pulled out. Also, the tuition payments that are made to other school districts is often reported by the districts in instruction, although there are some technical problems with that because, let's say, you're paying a bill to another district for educating one of your kids. Quite often, for simplicity's sake, the district will put all of that in instruction. But we know that when the district is sending the bill, they also have instructional support and utility costs and other costs that are being built into there. And that avoided that problem in terms of forcing those districts to then break down those tuition bills into more detail in order to provide a more accurate picture of instruction versus non-instruction.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Melcher. And I guess that's what I was trying to understand. So right now we have a category of line items in UFARs that are called instructional expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're saying is we want to have school districts report what percentage of their spending is in that category of instructional expenditures less these defined things that
yes.
you're showing here that you could arguably say are not necessarily academic or, as you pointed out, with the other tuition payments, there might be some other problems. So I guess, to me, the debate might be, is UFARs defining instructional expenditures accurately, and if some of the things that people are talking about should be included in instructional expenditures, maybe it goes to refining UFARs coding to include some of these things that people are debating. So thank you.
And Senator Hahn and members, we did pass legislation last session to look at an additional form of reporting for school districts that might be a more an accurate representation of what many of the stakeholders believed was instructional learning, and that legislation was passed, and we're in the process of implementing that, and I think there's still some issues to work out with that, but after we have that worked out, we'll make sure and let members know what that looks like as well. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think it would be useful. I don't know what is the easiest way to to have access or review what those UFARS categories are again. I don't think we all store them in our brains, as well as the new model that Senator Bonhoff has mentioned. I think having a look at that would help us so that we'd have some basis for determining whether we think it's what's included fits a current model, rather than get into arguments that we really haven't got a good foundation of information that mm-hmm. would give us a basis for making some other changes. Maybe we'd exclude something or add something, mm-hmm. Either by this statute or recommend it to be a change in the reporting system itself.
Madam Chair and
Senators, Dr. Melcher
and members, we would be happy to provide you with the definitions for the UFARS categories and updated data for what the data runs would look like, and we can also provide you with what that consolidated financial report looks like, which also provides data for each school district showing how these things break out. And in fact, in that report, we have included some of these instructional support, things like librarians, et cetera, in right next to the instructional piece, so you can see how that would combine to give you a combined figure.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I think when we discuss General that again, that would be useful information. Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Madam Chair, moving on to Article 6, which is the library section.
Yeah, and members, we are going to, for right now, skip the early childhood section and come back to that so that we can take the adequate amount of time that would need, and so we're moving right to the library section.
Okay.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 1 is a comprehensive library structure study. The governor is recommending $200,000 to undergo a study of our current library system. As you may know, we have regional libraries, we have multi-type libraries, we have libraries within school districts, we have libraries within higher education. And what this is attempting to do is looking at the system and seeing if there could be better alignment with library services across the state. We are asking for additional money to contract with an independent consultant to do this because we feel that it is important to have someone that doesn't have that has independence in making this review and recommendation. Section 2, the governor is recommending a 2% increase for the basic system support for libraries. This is consistent with many of us recommendations for increases of 2%, and that can be found in subdivision 2. Madam Chair, the other appropriations are base funding that's just carried forward from the previous biennium. Skipping over Article 7, moving to Article 8.
Deputy Commissioner, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're gonna end with this section, okay. And we're going to take this bill up again next Wednesday. And then on Tuesday, we will be doing our fund transfers and local levies. So thank you very much for your presentation, Deputy Commissioner, and thank you, members. The meeting is adjourned.
Tricia?
Just briefly.
Good job.
Give her a hard time. You have to give her credit.
Right.